Ashu, like many of us, we keep being astounded when we think that this president has reached a new low, but he always manages to find an even deeper low to drop into. I wanted to ask you about some of the work that you did with Martin at Witness Against Torture. What were some of the activities you were involved in together, and what drove him to be involved?
Yeah. So the work that we would do is every January we go to D.C. for a week of fasting and action and prayer. So it's really an advocacy week in which we spend all day, every day together thinking about the ways in which we can creatively express our outrage at the continued injustices perpetrated by our government. And so our time together was really often spent in circles, deciding how are we going to best do a creative action, and then going out into the streets of D.C., to the Supreme Court, to the White House, to express to the government as well as to the people the need for human rights in Guantanamo and all military prisons, as well as prisons throughout this country.
I wanted to go to Martin in his own words. Martin Gugino recently submitted a video statement to a judge in Georgia presiding over the case of the Kings Bay Plowshares, the seven-piece activists who broke into a nuclear submarine base in 2018. Martin quoted from the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr.
It really starts with this quote.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland. And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, coronavirus numbers are on the rise in Oregon as the state continues to reopen. Complaints about the Portland police have skyrocketed over the past 2 weeks, and in international news, President Trump intends to expand U.S. operations in the Arctic and Antarctic regions. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 10th, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. More Oregonians have been identified with coronavirus in the past week than any time previous, with hospitalizations for the virus spiking by 40%. The number of daily infections bottomed out 2 weeks ago, but now has doubled. This comes after Governor Kate Brown has approved 29 of the state's 36 counties to enter Phase 2 of reopening. State public health officials said the rising case counts are not necessarily a cause for alarm, with over 120 employees at Pacific Seafood in Lincoln County testing positive and statewide testing at record levels. Cases in the three Portland metro area counties are also on the rise, and Multnomah County is still under the stay-at-home restrictions that began statewide in March. Oregon is among several states, including Florida and Texas, who have seen a rise in COVID cases since easing restrictions. Overall, 21 states have seen cases rising since beginning the reopening process. Oregon has now 5,060 confirmed or presumed cases of COVID-19 and 169 deaths. In Washington, there have been over 24,000 cases, with 1,176 deaths. In the United States as a whole, there have been nearly 2 million cases of the virus and over 112,000 deaths. Worldwide, there have been over 7 million confirmed cases of the virus, with over 400,000 deaths. Multnomah County is planning to enter Phase 1 of the reopening process on Friday. Entering Phase 1 would ease restrictions on many businesses and increase permitted gathering size to 25 people. Barbershops, salons, and massage businesses will be allowed to open by appointment only and must include social distancing and a customer list. Restaurants and bars will be open for sit-down service and will require employees to wear masks and provide 6 feet between tables. County officials have asked Governor Kate Brown to provide mandatory COVID-19 testing in nursing homes, a hotbed for COVID-19 activity in the state. They have also requested a requirement for everyone to wear masks in public places. Speaking to everyone wearing masks in public, Commissioner Sharon Mirren, an emergency room physician, said last week, quote, When you put down a double barrier between people, you significantly lower the risk of transmission. Multnomah County is the most densely populated county in the state and has the most confirmed coronavirus cases. It is the last county to apply for reopening approval, and some counties around the state have already been approved to enter Phase 2. Multnomah County officials are keeping an eye on the number of hospitalizations as well as the number of new COVID cases identified each day. After entering Phase 1, Multnomah County will have to wait at least 21 days before it is eligible to apply for Phase 2. An independent police watchdog has received over 2,300 complaints about Portland police recently. With more on that story, here's KBOO's Nat Moon.
An oversight agency for the Portland Police Bureau has received more than 2,300 police-related complaints just in the past week, says Irene Konev of the Independent Police Review. Portland police have been criticized for what many people call an excessive use of force against protesters and bystanders. The police have consistently deployed clouds of tear gas, shot rubber bullets at close range, and used the long-range acoustic device, which can cause chronic migraines and hearing loss. One protester who attended a demonstration on June 2nd has filed a lawsuit against the city, saying that an officer, quote, used a military-style weapon to launch projectiles into his arm and stomach. He is suing the city for battery and seeking up to $250,000. A similar situation is taking place in cities across the country. Seattle is processing nearly 12,000 complaints against officers after just 2 days of protests. In Seattle, frequent complaints include pepper spraying peaceful demonstrators, including young children, punching people already on the ground being arrested, and covering up badge numbers. Reporting for KBOO Evening News, I'm Nat Moon.
A federal judge on Tuesday granted a 2-week court order banning Portland police from using tear gas on protesters, except for when life is at risk. The ruling comes after Don't Shoot PDX and two other plaintiffs sued the city of Portland and showed to the court the threat of immediate and irreparable harm in the absence of a court order. They also raised the serious question of whether their free speech rights were being violated by the deployment of tear gas. Judge Marco A. Hernandez wrote in his ruling on Tuesday, quote, "Given the effects of tear gas and the potential deadly harm posed by the spread of COVID-19, plaintiffs have established a strong likelihood that the police engaged in excessive force contrary to the Fourth Amendment," end quote. Hernandez gave his ruling after watching video evidence of tear gassing at recent protests in Portland. In the ruling, the judge also said that, quote, "There is even evidence that some protesters were confronted with tear gas while trying to follow police orders and leave the demonstrations." The ruling on Tuesday seemed to echo Mayor Ted Wheeler's statement on Saturday that police shall not use tear gas unless there is, quote, "a serious and immediate threat to life safety." Critics of Wheeler's statement said his words didn't go far enough to actually restrict the use of tear gas as a, quote, "threat to life safety," and could have variable meanings to police officers. Portland's Deputy City Attorney Naomi Sheffield argued that the Police Bureau's directives already significantly restrict the use of tear gas, though there have been numerous documented reports of its use over the past few weeks. For Oregonians without legal status who were excluded from receiving federal coronavirus aid, the Oregon Worker Relief Fund will be distributing over $1 million per week to people who are undocumented. Eric Tegedoff has that story.
Left out of the last stimulus bill from Congress, Oregonians without legal status are getting aid within the state. The Oregon Worker Relief Fund aims to distribute $1.3 million a week among people who are undocumented. With the infrastructure to distribute money built out, the program is holding a town hall today on how to access funds. Ramon Valdez is with the Innovative Law Lab, which designed the software for allocating aid.
Over the past decade, we've chosen to exclude undocumented immigrants from so many programs because of their legal status, yet we rely on them for so many different reasons, both economic and cultural and community reasons. They're a part of our community.
There are about 74,000 undocumented immigrants in Oregon, according to the Oregon Center for Public Policy. About 86,000, or 1 in 10, Oregon children live with a family member who is undocumented. More than 100 organizations came together to create the fund, including the Latino Network, ACLU of Oregon, the Farm Workers Union PICUN, and the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon. Susanna Morgan heads Oregon Food Bank, which also is a supporter. She says hunger is a symptom of unequal access to things like healthy food, employment, and housing.
What this pandemic and associated economic crisis has taught us is that with adequate public investment, we can dramatically reduce hunger in Oregon as long as all families are included. And that is why the Oregon Worker Relief Fund is critical.
The program is collecting donations from Oregonians and philanthropy groups and has received $20 million from the Oregon legislature. But the groups behind the fund estimate it needs more than $120 million to help every undocumented person in the state. Adriana Miranda with the immigrant rights group CAUSA says they'll continue raising money.
It's a great investment, and we applaud the Oregon legislature for their leadership, but we know it's not sufficient to meet the full need of these Oregon families.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Some Georgia residents waited over 5 hours to vote yesterday due to many polling places being closed and problems with voting machines and insufficient staffings in those locations that were still open. A court order kept polling places open until those in line could vote. In many places, that lasted until after 11 p.m. Since the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act in 2013, Georgia has closed 214 polling places, including 60 in Metro Atlanta, where a majority of the state's black voters live. Congressional Democrats have passed legislation to restore the Voting Rights Act, but Senator Mitch McConnell is blocking it from being considered in the Senate. In response to long lines at a polling place in Atlanta, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York said, quote, "This is by design, and it's their test run for November." She continued, "Republicans don't want vote by mail because it chips away at their ability to do exactly this, target and disenfranchise black voters and people of color." 5 states held primaries yesterday, Georgia, as we mentioned, but also in North Dakota, Nevada, South Carolina, and West Virginia. Georgia voters faced particularly long lines, malfunctioning voting machines, and last-minute changes to polling places, while in North Dakota, voters had no in-person polling places, only mail-in ballots and drop boxes. With more on the story, here's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
There's some impetus behind wanting our elections to remain as inefficient as they've been. And, you know, because generally that keeps a certain demographic of people from voting, particularly people of color, right?
Pastor Billy Michael Honor from Voting Rights Group New Georgia Project monitored what's being called the meltdown in Georgia, mostly in the Atlanta area, where voters in predominantly black precincts faced hours-long lines, malfunctioning voting machines, and last-minute changes to polling locations.
Issues related to voter suppression are highlighted once again, and it wakes people up to understand that in the same way that we need to be in the streets protesting against anti-black racism and violence is the same way that we need to also be protesting against the assault on democracy that we continue to see every time we have elections.
Including Georgia, 5 states held primaries yesterday: South Carolina, West Virginia, Nevada, and North Dakota. Naomi McDougall-Jones recently moved to Georgia. She sent in her absentee ballot weeks ago. The day before Election Day, she got a notice that her ballot had been rejected, directing her to her polling place.
When I got there, there was a sign out front saying that our polling place had been moved a mile away. Then I ran into my neighbors, one of whom told me that his son had been at that polling place since 7 a.m. and still hadn't managed to vote, and it was 10:30 at that point.
South Carolina's capital, Columbia, also had hours-long lines. In North Dakota, all in-person polling sites were closed, voters had to request absentee ballots, and then either mail or get them to secure drop boxes. That's a problem for North Dakota's indigenous communities, where there's only one drop box per reservation or county. Some reservations cross multiple counties, so a drop box could be 30 to 50 plus miles away. State Representative Ruth Buffalo is the first Native American Democratic woman elected to the North Dakota legislature.
We're hoping in the future that people will have drop boxes in each of the respective communities within the Indian reservation. So that would mean for Fort Berthold, that would look like having 6 drop boxes total, as opposed to the current situation of just having one drop box there for over 1 million acres of land.
Beyond the distance and difficulties for people with disabilities or who need language assistance, Buffalo says most people on reservations use post office boxes rather than street addresses. It can be a challenge just to get to the post office regularly.
Not everybody has a ride or access to get to the post office, and just given COVID-19 times, we know that a lot of the mail is delayed.
Former Vice President Joe Biden offered condolences to George Floyd's family in an emotional recorded message played at the private Houston funeral service yesterday. Recently, Biden spent millions and likely raised more from Facebook and Google ads condemning President Trump's militarized response to protests sparked by the latest police killing. Biden still has a ways to go. Trump's re-election campaign has been raising money since his inauguration. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News in Depth. At 6, it's Right to Survive. Then at 7, tune in for Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 58. Tomorrow's weather also cloudy with a high of 72. Today in history, on this date, in 1958, Angelina Weld Grimke died. Grimke was a journalist, teacher, playwright, and poet who came to prominence during the Harlem Renaissance. She was one of the first women of color to have a play performed in the United States. The quote of the day is from Angela Weld Grimke, who said, quote, "I recognize no rights but human rights." Demonstrators in Wisconsin are voicing concerns over an incident involving native spearfishers. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Last month, a man shot off a gun near tribal spearfishers on a lake in northern Wisconsin. For many, that brought back memories of protests over native spearfishing rights in the 1980s and 90s. The man involved in the recent incident says he was shooting at a squirrel on his property, but is now facing misdemeanor hate crime charges. Some tribal members want tougher prosecution. Ben Meyer explains.
The protest Monday morning in front of the Vilas County Courthouse was silent but noticeable. People like Shannon Ratana held signs demanding justice for tribal members and respect for treaty rights.
We're tired of the hate. We're tired. Racism is hatred, and feeding and allowing that to continue for so long it's unacceptable, and we're not going to stand for it. We won't tolerate it anymore.
On the night of May 2nd, Ratana's uncle and three others were practicing their federally protected right to spearfish for walleye off-reservation, this time on Little St. Germain Lake. On shore, 61-year-old James Kelsey fired a shotgun. He says he was firing at a squirrel on his property. Ratana doesn't buy it.
So that's why my shirt says he's not a squirrel. You know, clearly he's not a squirrel. He's a man.
No one was hurt by the shots, but police arrested Kelsey that night. He was charged with two misdemeanors, including a hate crime. But Kelsey's attorney, Steve Lucarelli, told me his client really was firing at a red squirrel on his property.
These were two unrelated events. Assumptions have been made that they are related. There's a reasonable explanation for what occurred.
The attorney said he's concerned the episode is being blown out of proportion, but Kelsey's bond includes restrictions on guns, alcohol, and going onto tribal lands. The case comes against the backdrop of protests over the spearfishing rights of Ojibwe tribal members, which started in the 1980s and, at times, became violent and racist. Brittany Lerdahl, a Lac des Flambeaux tribal member holding a sign on Monday, says she had hoped the Northwoods was past those days.
I was just hoping that I would read about it in the 80s and never really thought I would have to relive it.
For National Native News, I'm Ben Meyer in Eagle River, Wisconsin.
The leader of a tribal group tackling transboundary issues is retiring. Tiz Peterman has led the Southeast Alaska Indigenous Transboundary Commission since 2017.
I've worked projects all my life, and I just decided it's time to take time for myself.
A few months after the commission was formed in 2014, the Mount Polley mine spilled waste into British Columbia waters. Incoming Executive Director Frederick Olson says there are other mine activities that feed into Alaska's rivers and salmon habitat.
Everybody already knows about Mount Polley. That's just a minuscule little blip on the map compared to Red Chris Mine, which is operating in the Stikine River watershed right now.
The commission is working to address issues on both sides of the border.
There's a lot more transboundary issues than mining. You know, there's also the cruise ship waste, there's oil tankers, there's murdered and missing Indigenous women, on and on.
Olson has worked as the Commission's outreach coordinator and board chair. The U.S. House Appropriations Subcommittee on the Interior, Environment, and Related Agencies will hear about the healthcare response to COVID-19 in Indian Country. A hearing is scheduled Thursday to gather testimony on the Indian Health Service response and the use of emergency COVID-19 funding. Witnesses include leaders from the Indian Health Service, the National Indian Health Board, and the National Council of Urban Indian Health. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Just hours after George Floyd was buried next to his mother's body in Houston, his younger brother Philonis testified at a congressional hearing in Washington on Wednesday. As protests against police brutality and systemic racism sparked by George Floyd's murder in Minneapolis entered a third week, his brother told the representatives, quote, "I'm tired. I'm tired of the pain I'm feeling now. I'm tired of the pain I feel every time another black person is killed for no reason. I'm here today to ask you to make it stop." Earlier this week, Democrats unveiled sweeping legislation aimed at combating excessive use of force by police and limiting legal protections for officers accused of misconduct. Several governors and mayors have already taken action to limit police weaponry and tactics, banning chokeholds and tear gas. A veto-proof majority of the Minneapolis City Council has pledged to replace the city's police department with a new community-based system of public safety. Artists around the country are seeking racial justice through artistic expression. Mike Moen from the Public News Service has that story.
From Middle America to Europe, murals have popped up in honor of George Floyd amid the renewed fight for racial justice. And in South Dakota, there are parallels to other works that call attention to the issues of systemic racism. Jim Spears, who heads the group Art South Dakota, says the George Floyd paintings remind him of exhibits highlighting the massacre at Wounded Knee and the treaty at Fort Laramie.
Both of those topics are sensitive and difficult topics to discuss in South Dakota, because it's kind of a black eye on our past in this state, and it's through art that these conversations can continue.
Those exhibits were led by the Center for American Indian Research and Native Studies on the Pine Ridge Reservation. While there haven't been many public displays to surface yet in South Dakota related to George Floyd, Spears believes that will change. He says it's only a matter of time before local artists find inspiration from the global movement and make their voices heard through their art. Spears sees some funding gaps for artists in South Dakota, although he says the state does a solid job in distributing the money it does have so that more people can create works that inspire conversation about serious topics.
There's certainly gaps in our work, but I think as far as a state with minimal resources, I think we've done a good job of being stewards of the dollars.
State data show that nearly 90% of South Dakota counties received an arts grant of some form during the recent funding cycle, including tribal areas. Mike Moen, Public News Service.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael agrees our streets, but whose country?
13 nights and counting, from Revolution Hall to I-84, from the Burnside Bridge to Pioneer Courthouse. Whose streets? Our streets, except with the police have fenced off. Over 11,000 U.S. protesters arrested in 2 weeks. Whose police? The property owners, to preserve and protect the existing inequality. It's one's right to be a racist, to walk the streets heavily armed and unmasked, adding to the systemic health threats of low wages, pollution, factory food, and no medical care. When America started, only white male property owners could vote, and some want to go back there, making voting more difficult. Ask the folks in Georgia and Wisconsin, why are the most polling places closed in neighborhoods of color? If only it was as easy to change mayors as police chiefs. If only we can still change presidents. Trump finally got his wall around the White House to keep Americans out. Maybe all the art and emotion on Trump's wall will become a cocoon for the metamorphosis of America, the many laid caterpillars of protest and equality becoming a free-flying swarm, manifesting our creative, constructive, and compassionate destiny. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
As if almost 800 military bases over 70 countries and territories wasn't enough, President Trump wants to expand U.S. operations in the Arctic and around Antarctica. The president has ordered the construction of a fleet of icebreakers and bases to support them as the U.S. pursues resources in the polar regions. The U.S. currently has just one heavy icebreaker and one medium icebreaker, while Russia has 40. Finland has 7, and Canada and Sweden have 6 each. As sea ice melts, countries bordering the Arctic, including the U.S., Canada, Norway, and Russia, they're competing over sea routes and laying territorial claims to now accessible and valuable seabed minerals. Although it does not have an Arctic coastline, China is also laying claim to resources, thereby funding other countries' infrastructure projects. President Trump's campaign has sent a cease and desist letter to CNN over a public opinion poll that the campaign says is, quote, designed to mislead the American public. Here's KBOO's Nat Moon with more on that story.
President Donald Trump's re-election campaign has demanded that CNN retract and apologize for a recent poll showing him well behind presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden. The demand came in the form of a cease and desist letter to CNN President Jeff Zucker and apparently contained numerous incorrect and misleading claims. The demand was immediately rejected by the network. The poll in question was conducted by SSRS, an independent research company, and shows Trump trailing Biden by 14 points, 55% to 41% among registered voters. Trump's campaign argues that the CNN poll is, quote, designed to mislead American voters through a biased questionnaire and skewed sampling. David Vigilante, CNN's executive VP and general counsel, in response said, quote, to my knowledge, this is the first time in its 40-year history that CNN has been threatened with legal action because an American politician did not like the polling results. Several other polls released over the past few weeks also indicate that Biden leads well ahead of Trump. Trump has a well-documented history of rejecting polls that don't paint him favorably. Last month, he lashed out at Fox News for a poll that showed him trailing Biden by 8 points and instead pointed to a different CNN poll that showed him leading against Biden in certain states. Reporting for KBOO Evening News, I'm Nat Moon.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 10th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael, Althea Billings, and Nat Moon. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Antonia Gonzalez, Mike Moen, and Eric Tegadoff. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's KBOO Talk Radio. At 9, we'll hear Press Watch featuring the news you're not supposed to know with host Teresa Mitchell. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative journalism with Dennis Burnt. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, we'll hear Between the Covers, featuring an interview with Kai Emmons, author of the new story collection called Vanishing. And at 11:30, it's Words and Pictures. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our listeners. If you would like to support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm, or you can use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. We'll be right back.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Portland's longest-standing Citizen Police Oversight Board is the Citizen Review Committee, which is part of the Auditor's Office Independent Police Review Division, or IPR. The CRC is an 11-member, all-volunteer body that hears appeals of police misconduct cases. The CRC has a strict standard of review that requires its members to consider only the evidence that internal police investigators had available to them. The CRC cannot gather or consider new evidence. Right now, the CRC is recruiting new applicants to fill 5 positions, reaching the end of their terms this year. The CRC has seen both unprecedented success and slightly more typical upheaval over the past year, culminating in the resignation of several members, including Committee Chair Kristen Malone. For more on the recruitment process and the current state of the Citizen Review Committee, KBOO reporter Sam Bowman spoke to Irene Konev, IPR's Senior Community Outreach Coordinator. We should say that a number of the CRC's cases, including many of those covered by KBOO in the past few years, have focused on police responses to protest events. However, this interview was conducted in the days before this past weekend's major demonstrations and does not address the numerous documented instances of questionable police behavior during those events.
So there's currently a recruitment effort underway for the CRC, the Citizen Review Committee.
Yes.
How many positions are being filled right now?
So we have 5 people terming out, which means that the 5 people who are on the Citizen Review Committee need to reapply for their positions again. And the 5 people that are on will compete for the positions with the other people, the new people that are applying.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So currently, how many positions are filled on the CRC?
There are a total of 11 positions, and there are 3-year terms, and they go through a rigorous selection process. We find community leaders who understand how our process works, and we try to bring in a broad representation of people to select the applicants. And then the applicants go through an interview process, and this is all per city code that was established when IPR was set up.
Okay, and is there a alternate pool that you draw from for CRC positions?
Yeah, so we try to, because you know this is a volunteer position, and this is it can be a lot of work sometimes, because an appeal can involve many pages of police reports to police records to go through, and so sometimes people, you know, make a commitment of 3 years, but you know things happen. We've had several members who got promoted. 2 of our members ran for office recently, and so like people move to different positions, and so they resign. And so having a pool of alternates ready to go and trained is our process.
Okay, and you mentioned a little bit about some of the outreach that's being done, but more specifically, what sort of outreach do you do for a recruitment push like this?
Yeah, well, our application is usually up on the website before we begin the active process of recruiting. So I reach out to neighborhood associations and business leaders, colleges, church groups. I have a huge network of people I reach out to, Portland State University, Oregon Health and Science University, Warner Pacific College. I have contacts all over the city. I've been in this job for 11 years now, and I've met a lot of friends who became allies of our work. And so they send it out on their social media. And sometimes we put it on Oregon Live, depending on how many positions we're looking for. And so it's basically networks of networks of networks how our application goes out, and you know, spending time on the radio and talking about it as well.
All right. And you So what sort of training would recruits go through before being a fully active member of the CRC?
So we take them through an actual case of how they would review a case that would come before them in the appeal process. So that's about a 3-hour training where we walk them through this is how the appeal file looks like. Here's a checklist of things to think about. Making sure that they're using a non-biased approach, evidence-based approach to their file review. And we also do a session on trauma-informed approach to this work. We have equity training, equity, diversity, and inclusion training that is usually within the first. So the first one would be like an overview of who IPR is, Independent Police Review, like who we are, how we were formed, a little bit of the history. There's often a session from the auditor. She comes in and basically does an overview of her office. This training is done in conjunction with folks from the internal affairs who talk about how to review a police review board case. So it's pretty intense, and it's very, we try to prepare our volunteers as much as possible. And then they spend one day, like as part of this education process at the training division. Before COVID, it was an in-person training. I don't know how we're going to move forward now, but they basically partner up with a police officer. They deploy a taser. They can use a shooting range. They do automobile maneuvers. They do scenario-based negotiations and things like that. So they basically walk with an officer for a day. And then they're also required to go on a ride-along before they review cases.
I'm not sure how to phrase this exactly, but is there a component of the training that that involves members of the community to give new CRC members an idea of sort of the perspective of some sectors of the community on this sort of work?
Are you talking about that they have a better understanding of policing through the eyes of different people who may experience police differently?
Yeah, I think to get an idea of the experience of sort of being policed rather than doing police work.
Right. I'm glad you brought that up, because that is the first hour of the equity training. We basically talk about the origins of policing, and we talk about how did policing become part of the process in America, and basically from way back in the 1700s, 1800s, and how law enforcement was used in basically the oppression of people, and that we go through that whole process from that equity lens of what it might feel like to be policed. So that I'm glad you asked that question.
Great, thank you. I know that recently in the, I think I'm telescoping this whole COVID pandemic thing a little bit, so I'm really referring to the first months of the year and the end of last year. But there were some resignations from the CRC. I think Neil Simon, Daniel Schwartz, and Kristen Malone. Mm-hmm. Are any of those positions among the ones being filled, or have they been filled already?
Yeah, thank you for asking that question. Yeah, those positions were filled recently, and the way that we structure the recruitment is so that everybody isn't terming off at the same time. So the positions that you just mentioned, those were filled, and now we're running another recruitment because other positions are terming out. So we're just trying to make sure that there's a rotation of people. So when I first started, they all were terming out at the same time. And what we found was that it was really hard to get 9-10 positions at once, and that there wasn't that transfer of knowledge where all the people are new sometimes. Mm-hmm. But most people would reapply, but a lot of times we'd have so many new members that a lot of that institutional knowledge was lost. So we try to make sure that as new members are coming on, there are existing members who have some institutional memory.
And so it sounds like this, like five positions being open, is sort of a part of the process. It's not more or less than normal.
Yeah, no, it's part of the process because we had another large recruitment 3 years ago, and new members came on and they've stayed there three terms, and now those terms are up, and so the same people have to reapply for their positions, and it's going to depend on that applicant pool in this recruitment if the current members get selected or not. And like I said, again, that's per city code. But we make sure that there are usually six or seven people on the selection committee. So there's a broad perspective of who gets selected.
Okay. Are you able to talk about who's on that committee at all?
I know that your time is limited. I would love to add that what we're looking for, because a lot of people when I'm doing recruitment are like, what are you looking for? And so if you don't mind, I'd love to share what we're looking for. So we're looking for someone who can demonstrate ability to be like impartial and objective. And I know that we all come to our own biases about different things, but we're looking at someone who's going to be able to, because the appeals can be brought before the Citizen Review Committee from police officers too. Police officers have the right to bring an appeal to the CRC. Community members have the right to bring an appeal to the CRC. So what we're looking for is someone who's going to be able to see the side of policing, like what it's like to be a police officer, and also the community member. So they have to have that impartial, objective perspective. And obviously they have to have really good communication and listening skills, because these cases are reviewed, are voted on in public. The files are confidential that they read, but they deliberate in public. And so, you know, getting along with each other and really listening, and also listening to complainants or appellants when they're in front of them. So those are really important skills that we're looking for. And they have to be City of Portland residents, or they have to have a business that's registered at the City of Portland. And, you know, you alluded to this earlier, they have to be able to understand what it's like to be policed and like some of the historical context, because some of our cases that they hear might have bias-based type of pieces of the case that they have to look at. So,
okay.
And it's a pretty big time commitment too. So we ask a lot of our volunteers, but we prepare and train them really well.
Yeah, that was actually my last question was what is the hourly commitment roughly?
So if there's an appeal, so the standard meeting is once a month from 5:30 to about 7:30 or 8. If it's an appeal, so there's depending, like some appeal cases can have 150 pages of data to review. There might also be videos, so there's going to be time involved in reviewing the case. So we broadly, and then sometimes we have two appeals a month. That doesn't happen very often, but it can be as intense as 10 hours a week. But for the most part, it's that one monthly meeting that they have to attend the first Wednesday of the month. And if they work in work groups to bring forward policy reviews, then there's also like an hour or two. And volunteers can be really busy and work in several work groups, or they can work on appeals and just attend the meetings. It's really up to them.
Great. And so if people are interested, they can find the application on IPR's website?
Yes. The website is, I don't know if you...
PortlandOregon.gov/IPR.
Yep.
Okay.
And it's right on the then you, if you look on the Citizen Review Committee, it's right there on the left. Yeah, okay. And I can also share my phone number if someone wants to reach out to me and talk about this. The phone number is 503-823-2735. And I'm going to repeat it. It's 503-823-2735.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, too.
And is there anything else you'd like to add before we wrap up?
I just wanted to say that this is really, really important work. Often we get to make some policy recommendations at the CRC level that can impact an entire bureau, and that is where the highest impact the volunteers have. So I would just encourage people who want to see change apply.
Great. Well, Irene Konev, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you, too.
That was KBOO reporter Sam Bowman speaking with Irene Konev, the Senior Community Outreach Coordinator at the City Auditor's Independent Police Review Division.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO with news from your community radio station.
You are listening to News from the Boo here on KBOO Community Radio, your local community station, here on KBOO Portland. I am Jenny Yokoyama. I'm one of your interim station co-manager, and of course, I am joined by my fellow interim station co-manager, Celeste.
Yes, Celeste Carey. I am the other. So, how's everybody out there in KBOO listener land, KBOO volunteer land, KBOO supporter land? How you doing? You enjoying the day? Good. Because we got good news for you. We got good news. We're going to do this teaser thing again. Well, I am. Because we can't tell you, but you should be expecting something wonderful to happen in July. That's all I can say. And if you want to get a little bit more information and you didn't catch Dr. Jane, Medicine Woman, Blues Junction show on Saturday, I guess you'll have to